It's Thursday, November 11, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. A report in the New York Times indicates that the black achievement gap is actually worse than had been expected. Trip Gabriel, writing for the paper, says, and I quote, "An achievement gap separating black from white students has long been documented, a social divide extremely vexing to policymakers, and the target of one blast of school reform after another." End quote. Now, the greatest concern cited in this article has to do with black males. Only 12% of black fourth grade boys are proficient in reading. That's compared with 38% of white boys. And only 12% of black eighth grade boys are proficient in math, compared with 44% of white boys. Now, Mr. Gabriel goes on to suggest that poverty alone does not seem to explain the differences, because poor white boys do just as well as African-American boys who do not live in poverty. This is measured by whether they qualify for subsidized school lunches. Now, when you look at this story, you realize that there is a lot of educational work that has gone into this in terms of statistical analysis. Someone's been taking a very clear look at these particular levels of reading and math ability when it comes to these boys in the fourth and in the eighth grades. Of course, you look forward in the educational process and you realize that boys who are not reading well in the fourth grade are likely to be the very same children who are not doing well in the eighth grade, who are likely to drop out of school before they graduate, or if they do graduate, are unlikely to go on to college, which means in a knowledge economy, they are at a very significant disadvantage. Now, one aspect of this story is genuinely interesting because it ties to so many of our other concerns. It has to do with the fact that many of the educators who are pointing to this knowledge and proficiency gap are suggesting that it is really rooted in the part of life that happens before these children even get to school. Now, there are very important factors and influences that do, indeed, impinge upon the question once these children are in school, but before they ever get to school, the analysis suggests that they are short on the kind of stimulation, the kind of conversation, the kind of background and momentum that would lead them to do well in school. They lack male role models who they see as able to do this kind of work and invested in this kind of learning. Now, this comes back to remind us that the family unit really does matter. And just as we were looking recently at the fact that 70% of black children are now born without a father in the home, these black boys are lacking the kind of relationship that a father would give, the kind of stimulation that a father would give, and the kind of motivation to learning that a father would give unto a son. This is witness to the fact that the family and marriage are irreplaceable. Once you start toying by social experimentation with the reality that children need married parents, they need both a mother and a father, once you have this epidemic of children born out of wedlock, there is virtually nothing that any government program can do to remedy the situation. Educators are being called on to answer a lot of America's most significant social ills. While there are definite problems of the educational system, one of the central problems is that we're asking educators to replace mothers and fathers and to repair the injury done by the breakdown of the family. That simply is too much for any educator or any government program or even any society to do on its own. In the aftermath of the mid-year elections, there is now a lame duck Congress, and that Congress has to face several decision points on its way to retiring just before the end of the year. Now, one of the issues that this Congress will have to consider, and the focus here is especially on the Senate, has to do with a military appropriations bill that will include, in its current form, a demand to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy of the U.S. military. Now, leaders in the Senate, on the Republican side, in particular Senator John McCain of Arizona, are demanding that that element be struck from the bill. This is going to be an interesting fight, but now even the New York Times and other national newspapers are suggesting that the future of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, at least in the U.S. Congress, is likely to be on hold until the new Congress convenes and we face a new political reality. But of course, this is not just a legislative question. There are court challenges to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that have already reached the point where it has taken a stay to prevent one federal court decision from eliminating and nullifying the policy altogether. We're going to be watching this issue very closely. It has to do not only with the military, but through the influence of the military in the culture and through the political ricochet effect of this kind of judicial decision, it's going to be interesting to see how all of this comes together in terms of reshaping the whole question of homosexuality in the culture. There's one other interesting aspect of this as well. Several of those who will be voting on this bill in terms of congressional action will be doing so on their way to retirement. This vote will be one way they'll be remembered in history. The Wall Street Journal is out with an interesting story this week that has to do with the news. It seems, of course, that the recent controversy over MSNBC's anchor Keith Olbermann has pointed to a deeper reality and a more complicated question in terms of the interaction between these celebrity news anchors, political opinion, and commercial income. Now, the Wall Street Journal article that was written by Douglas Blackman and Sam Schnechter suggests that on all sides of this equation, many of these newscasters are actually reaping a great deal of commercial and financial benefit by things that are unknown to the viewers of these programs. Some of these things have to do with endorsements. Others have to do with groups that are buying time on the programs to which there are certain commercial interests attached to the newscasters. Now, all of old media, virtually every newspaper and editorial staff, every major magazine of the days of the news weeklies and all the major TV news networks had very clear rules and strictures having to do with the policies for professionalism and the avoidance of any conflict of interest on the part of its journalists. Those days are largely over. Not so much for the old newspapers and news magazines, but for many in the blurred line between entertainment and editorializing and the news industry, well, that's where you find ground zero of a great deal of this confusion and likely conflict of interest. Now, there's no way to unpack this in a few brief comments, but it is another affirmation of the fact that we need to remember that what we're watching, especially on these commercial news networks on cable, are packaged programs that are entertainment, editorializing, some news, but a lot of opportunity for profit. The news, like everything else, is a commodity. And as a commodity, it has certain value. And there are those who would try to add financial value to that commodity and to offer opportunities for the newscasters to have a commercial incentive as well. You know, the old expression, buyer beware, caveat emptor. Well, in this case, viewer beware as you're watching the news. Understand that there is much more than meets the eye, and that all of these news programs are programs offered almost exclusively for profit. Now, the Wall Street Journal has another article of great interest. Erica Jong, the novelist, well known for her steamy novel Fear of Flying and some 20 others, has written an article for the Journal entitled Mother Madness. Now, is motherhood just too much of an imposition upon women today? You may remember that in recent months, Elizabeth Badinter of France has written a book to that effect that has made a lot of splash and is soon to be translated into English and published in both Great Britain and the United States. Erica Jong echoes many of the same comments. She points to some of the expectations of motherhood. She points specifically to the new fad of attachment parenting, and she suggests that that's just too much to expect of women. It's a backlash against feminism. Her words are witty, they are very sharp, and to be honest, they're quite unexpected in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Jong complains about the contemporary exhortations given to mothers to breastfeed their babies and to spend time with them, and she suggests that this is, in her words, a backlash against women's freedom, and it is a prison for mothers. Now, we've heard that kind of language before, but seldom in this kind of form in the Wall Street Journal, and not so much from this kind of unexpected source. Now, Ms. Jong goes on to suggest that in her own life, she discovered that motherhood, in terms of a traditional model of her staying home with the child and being on the child's schedule and giving the child priority in a professional life, that just wasn't for her. She warns that today's young mothers are giving up the advances hard won by their feminist foremothers. She says the first wave of feminists in the 19th century dreamed of communal kitchens and nurseries. 100 years later, the closest we have come to these amenities are fast food franchises that make our children obese and impoverished immigrant nannies who help us to raise our kids when their own kids are left at home with grandparents. Our foremothers might be appalled by how little we have transformed the world of motherhood. End quote. Now, the prejudice in her article against children and against motherhood becomes so explicit that she admits that societies probably cannot reconcile the different interests and needs of parents and children. In her own life, she makes clear, she left her children with a nanny and went off to airports and flights and bookstores and interviews and all the things she needed to do to publicize her books. Now, my guess is that very few American women are going to read this article and be moved to want to follow Erica Jong's example. Fewer still are going to read it and understand what is going on here, a deep-rooted resentment against what is seen as the loss of advances made by feminists in years past. Christians looking at this are likely to see a very different reality, and that is that motherhood tends to make demands upon women who come from within the women themselves rather than from society. It turns out that when mothers have babies, they, of all things, want to spend time with them. They discover great joy and fulfillment in the task of mothering and nurturing their children. And, this novelist to the side, most of them do not see this as a rejection of feminism, but rather as an acceptance of motherhood. Over time, I think we can count on the fact that motherhood will redefine feminism more than feminism will redefine motherhood. Finally, just this morning, the BBC is reporting that Amazon.com is now in a controversy over its sale of a book that offers advice to pedophiles. The Pedophile's Guide to Love and Pleasure, A Child Lover's Code of Conduct, is available as an ebook at Amazon.com, and hundreds of observers of the site have found it and registered complaints. Amazon.com, it turns out, has a set of policies that should eliminate books that are offensive materials, but it turns out that authors can override those guidelines, and that appears to be the case with this particular book. Now, responding to criticism, Amazon.com said that Amazon believes it is censorship not to sell certain books simply because we or others believe their message is objectionable. Amazon does not support or promote hatred or criminal acts. However, we do support the right of every individual to make their own purchasing decisions. Now, you'll have to decide whether you think that is a company's statement of principle or a corporate cop-out. But here's a prediction that I'll offer. I think Amazon.com will eventually find a way to get this book off of its site, and it should. Certain books, certain arguments, certain proposals, certain narratives have no place in a decent society. And any society that would have a place of toleration for a book that offers advice to pedophiles about how to conduct pedophilia, well, that's just so far beyond the pale. It is a wake-up call to a civilization that, once again, virtually anything can be commodified and someone will sell just about anything if there is a platform and a buyer. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to our website at albertmoeller.com. You'll find information about Southern Seminary at sbts.edu. Information about Boyce College is available at boycecollege.com. You can follow my regular updates on Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.